Welcome to the Laravel IO podcast. My name is Sean McCool, and I'm here with Taylor Otwell, Jeffrey Way, and Maxim Sergei. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Awesome. Nailed it first try. So, nice. First of all, thank you guys all for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting.
Maxim, it's the first time you're on the show. Could you just take a minute and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I'm a web developer, doing everything in Laravel right now. Have over 30 projects that I've built with Laravel, including a website that's called buildwithlaravel.com. And I am self-employed and am in process of writing 2 books, and that's about it.
So, yeah, man, you release a new site like every 2 weeks. It makes some of us look bad because every single time it's like, oh, check out this. Like the latest thing you released is pretty sick. The it's not Laravel related. It's that little polygon wall generator.
Yeah, that was just I got sick. Yeah, when I get sick, I get really creative. The first time I got sick 2 years ago, I made Bootsnip, and this time I got sick, I made this thing.
There's probably room for a really inappropriate comment in here, though. I'm just going to pass on that.
Yeah, I've heard some people are wishing me that I'm going to be sick all the time so that I'll do some more cool stuff. But I'm like, no, it's fine.
Oh, for me, I get sick and then I just whine and sleep.
So. Yeah, I just play like Zelda or something and that's it.
Yep. I live in Seattle area. I just moved here from California. And before that, I moved from Ukraine 10 years ago.
Okay. So, it seems like just yesterday that we recorded a podcast.
Definitely. Yeah, I was just here.
No, it's good for it to be consistent.
Yeah.
A lot of podcasts I listen to, they'll go 3 months without releasing anything. And I get it, you know, people are busy. But, yeah, it's nice to have a constant thing to listen to.
Yeah, I really like doing it, but it can be difficult to, like, schedule everybody and get everything together. So, I'm really happy to have you, Taylor, and you, Jeffrey, like, kind of recurring people to come back. It makes things a lot easier.
We're always here for you. I was telling Ian, like, I hardly ever finish a podcast because I accidentally close the browser tab first. So, like, I've tried to make it through his Bootstrapped FM with Andrew Butoff, which is an awesome podcast. I, like, always get about halfway through and then accidentally close the browser tab, and it really sucks.
I've gotten into this new thing. Like, I know it's crazy, but when I exercise, like, if I go running, I listen to a podcast now, and I never did that before. I'd always listen to music, but, man, it makes the time go by so fast. I really do recommend it for anyone. Like, even if you're just on a treadmill, just put on a podcast, and you have to run for as long as that podcast is going, which is usually, like, 30 or 45 minutes. But, yeah, I really like it. It's a good way to catch up on this stuff, too.
That's exactly what I do, except for usually, like, This American Life or Radiolab or Freakonomics or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are some awesome This American Life episodes.
It's my favorite podcast of all time, basically.
Yeah.
Relevant to non-Americans as well, I promise.
Yeah, the stories are really interesting. I like it. I need to start exercising, too, also, by the way. That reminded me.
Okay. Before we started recording, we asked a bunch of people on Twitter if they had anything interesting to maybe ask or anything that we could talk about. And I think we got a lot of really good responses today, actually.
Bring it on.
Bring it on? Okay.
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Well, topic out there.
Here. I want Taylor and Jeffrey, I want you guys to start talking about testing stuff. Because, Taylor, I saw you say something about 100% minimum. Could you tell me a little bit about that, what you were meaning there?
Yeah. Well, it all kind of started with earlier today. There was a keynote apparently at RailsConf in Chicago by DHH, the guy who's behind Rails. And he was I caught it kind of – I think I got in about halfway through. But basically he was talking about how – he thinks that TDD can sometimes be a detriment to your design instead of instead of improving your design, which this is not really a new topic for him. He's kind of been critical of TDD in the past with various blog articles. But anyway, it reminded me that on you know, there's kind of been a large focus in PHP, as we've talked about, with better design patterns and better architecture. And as part of that, obviously, more testing, and there's better testing tools like PHP Spec and Behat and Mockery and, of course, PHP Unit. And basically, questioning, is 100% code coverage good? And maybe not so much good, but is it necessarily like a something you should shoot for as like an indicator of project quality? So with Laravel, like to kind of start the discussion kind of where Laravel's at, it doesn't have 100% coverage. And the way I kind of approach testing is I try to test the stuff that has a lot of churn. So like I don't necessarily test obviously like getters and setters and stuff like that, which is just like return this property or whatever. We don't test that, of course, but definitely stuff like Eloquent and authentication and all that stuff has a lot of tests. And I do kind of feel like frameworks should have more tests maybe than other stuff, just because it handles a lot of really sensitive code. But yeah, I don't necessarily shoot for 100%. I don't necessarily do test driven development very much, because I try to kind of keep a, I kind of stay in like a testable mindset rather than necessarily always writing the test first. So as I'm writing code, I'm kind of always thinking, will I be able to test this, you know, when I write some tests? Because I'm always kind of tinkering with like, what's the best API? Or I kind of build the consumable part first before I get down into the nitty gritty of writing tests. So yeah.
But in order to get to that point where, like you mentioned, when you're writing code, you're thinking, is this testable? That's one of those things you have no idea if it is testable until you start writing these tests. So I could imagine somebody that's never done any kind of TDD or written tests at all, they wouldn't really know what to look for. So all of this stuff we talk about is really connected, like dependency injection and all of these principles. Like they're all very much linked to making testing easier to do, but it's one of those things where unless you write these tests, you won't exactly understand the benefit.
Yeah.
So, like, from my perspective, when it comes to TDD, absolutely not 100%. I do, like, 50-50, honestly. The hardest thing is sometimes it's really hard. Like, all right, let's say you're doing TDD and you create a test, but you're not exactly sure what you want to do yet. And I guess that's, and from one perspective, that's a good thing. It gives you a minute to just take a step back and think, all right, what am I trying to do here? But many times, especially when you're talking about, like, testing the messages that are sent from one object to another, you don't really know it all. So in those cases, I'll find myself like, all right, I'll put away the test and then I'll just play around for a little bit and just see like what shape this is going to take. And then a lot of people would say, once you have a better feel or a better grasp of what you want to do, then throw away all that code and start over doing TDD. I don't do that, but I can see the benefit to that kind of cycle.
Yeah. So how I approach, like, say I'm going to write a new package, how I would do it, or I'm going to write a new feature of Laravel, I open up a blank Sublime Text document and I write exactly how I want to use it. So like with Cashier, I wrote out user subscription create, user subscription cancel, user subscription prorate with coupon create, blah, blah, blah. I wrote all those various like consumption, so to speak. And I'm not even thinking if it's testable. Like, I'm going to make it testable. Like, this is the API that's going to happen, and I'm going to figure out a way to make it testable. Like, I don't start the other way around. And, like, if I can't pull that off, like, I'm going to keep hacking at it until I hit that API, because it's just, that's just the way it has to be. You know what I mean? Like, that's just my level of how accessible it has to be, and we're going to make the test work that way. So yeah. That's kind of why I don't do tests first, I guess, is because I'm designing that whole API first.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? It completely, especially with Cashier, I think, like, it's very clear that you designed that API before you wrote the code, because it's so intuitive. Like, even things like user subscription swap, if you want to, like, switch your monthly subscription up for a yearly, it's so readable. Yeah. So it's very clear that the API was well thought out before you had done anything. But some people could say you could have written that as a test first.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you could. Yeah. I just personally don't usually. What do you do, Sean?
Well, have you actually, like, sat down and built a project with TDD?
Yeah, in .NET days, yeah, not in PHP. But in, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I may be doing TDD wrong in PHP because, like, I end up with weird errors. Like, say I try to do TDD on, well, I guess I can't do, like, true TDD, I feel like, sometimes because I get weird PHP errors. So, like, if certain things don't exist or whatever yet, then I get weird errors. But I guess you just have to define, like, my interfaces first and put everything on an interface. And I don't know. I used to do it on .NET a lot more, mainly because we, our whole team did it. So it was kind of like a group, culture type thing.
Yeah. But, peer pressure.
Yeah, peer pressure.
Cult mentality.
I haven't done it in PHP, really.
I don't know. So I've put a lot of effort into TDD because I, at some point in time, decided this is just a really cool thing that I want to get grasp on. I didn't feel like, you know, I'd really be happy until I at least figured it out. So we started approaching it with Ruby, and we did some with PHP. And what I learned is that it works a little bit differently than what I expected. When you write something, you write your test, and then you write the code that makes it work. If you're getting an error, then you just keep writing code until the error passes. But the code you're writing isn't like the code that you're going to end up having in the end. The code that you're writing is just the code that will make the test pass. So it's like it's almost like you're hacking first. So you hack crap together to make it work. And then once it works, then you kind of go clean it up. And then you hack it again, and then you clean it up. And I really find that enjoyable. I find it, like, actively pleasant. It's almost like liberating.
Yeah.
I find tests extremely helpful in Laravel for regression testing and or refactoring, like Jeffrey mentioned, because we get a pull request, and of course it's all hooked up to Travis CI, and we can see if there's a regression. It's saved our butt so many times, having, you know, a good suite of tests. I think we're up to about 2,000 tests now, and it's really been really helpful on regressions and stuff.
Max, do you do testing or TDD or anything like that?
No, I still have to see the light in the end of the tunnel. And I don't have the big pens, the big boy pens, like Jeffrey Way says in his book. I'm still, like, for all my projects, I have no testing. I'm not doing any testing for the client projects, and for much bigger things, then that would be the way to go. But I'm not, like, I find just that it takes too much time for me to prototype my application, and my attention span sometimes is not that long. So I just want to knock it out today, you know, and I'm done.
It's the weirdest thing. It's very difficult to make yourself do it.
Like, yeah.
Gosh, I'm always curious about the people who are anti-testing. Like, the problem with what DHH said is, a lot of people are going to take that to mean testing, you don't need to do it. And that's not what he's saying at all. He's just saying maybe TDD specifically isn't necessarily the only way to create a good application. But he's not saying you shouldn't be testing as much as you can. He's just saying, what ratio do you do a test first? And I think in some of his articles he said something along the lines of like 70-30, 80-20 for him, or maybe even less. I can't remember what he said. But yeah, see, the problem with this is, once again, it's like everyone's trying to figure out the right way to do it. We bring this up all the time on these podcasts because everyone wants to know what to do. This stuff is complicated enough. You don't always want to figure it out for yourself. You just want somebody to say, here's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
One less thing to think about. You know, we have enough things to worry about. But the truth is, it's like, it kind of comes down to how you want to approach this. So my view with testing is, do I check to see if I have 100% code coverage? Never. It just doesn't ever come up. The way I approach it is, would I feel more comfortable having written this test? And that's it. So if it's something where I don't make that mistake, it's not something I'm worried about at all, I will not write the test. But if it's like, will this help you sleep better at night knowing that you have this automated verification that it works? And if the answer is yes, then it seems like a no-brainer to write the test.
I have a couple, like, I don't know, observations from myself and how I implement tests. So when I'm making a package nowadays, I'm aiming for like a minimum of 100% code coverage. And so you guys know how code coverage works?
Yep.
So
do you mean like how the tools actually analyze
exactly,
the code?
Or? Yes.
I'm not sure.
So I only really know how PHP Unit does it with Xdebug. And basically, when you run your tests, it will actually pay attention with XDebug about what code is run and what code, for example, what code in your classes are never hit during the course of your tests. So literally, if you test only one class in isolation and reference no other dependencies, you could have 1,000 classes that are untested, but PHP unit will say that you have 100% coverage because you covered every line in that one file that was loaded. Then again, if you load in a bunch more classes, like if you're not using auto loading and you're just like doing a bunch of requires, it'll give you a different result. So basically you can have 100% coverage by just hitting every single line, but that doesn't really mean that you're 100% covered, because when you're testing, you're not just making sure that you hit every line. You're trying to cover all these edge cases and behavioral scenarios and just making sure it behaves correctly. So you might have to cover the same line. Like one line in a class might get covered 20 times over the course of your test for that class, whereas another might get covered once, for example, throwing an exception in a specific scenario. So aiming for a minimum of 100% code coverage means that you probably could write more tests, but at least, you know, you're kind of close to having more of those things covered. So I don't actually believe for a minute that my package code, I'm testing for everything. I genuinely don't believe it. And I'm not really looking for infallibility. I'm more looking for, can I sleep at night? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I remember the early days when Laravel didn't have any tests, you know, back in like the first version or two. Man, those were scary, dark times back then.
I mean, you think about it. Somebody submits a pull request, and if you don't have those tests to verify whether it works or not, you have no idea. So you just have to basically try everything out and think of every possible way this could break the code. And nobody can do that. You know, that's a nightmare. So, yeah, especially for regression testing, like, I can't imagine how it would even be possible to maintain a project as big as Laravel without a very good test suite.
Yeah, we definitely could now. Not at this size.
Or just the query builder.
Gosh, yeah, we couldn't maintain just one aspect of Laravel.
Mm-hmm. Especially with Travis. It's so nice, somebody submits a pull request, and you immediately have an alert saying, hey, they broke the code, so
yeah,
you can just
amazing.
Ignore it for now. Oh, it's so nice.
Travis is just fantastic. It's so easy to set up, and basically, if anybody who's listening who doesn't know what Travis is, it's just, when you push to your GitHub remote or I don't know. It's only GitHub, right?
I don't know.
I think it's only GitHub, but whatever. It's free for public projects. You pay, like, I think $100 or something, $120 for access to your private repository. So if you're running a business on GitHub Private, whatever. But it just spins up a virtual machine, takes your code from the repo and builds it and runs whatever scripts you tell it to. So, like, for a Laravel app, it'll run your migrations, your database seeds. Then it'll run basically any scripts you want. And as long as those scripts return with a exit code of 0, then it considers it a success. If it returns any kind of failure, then it's going to mark the build as failing, and you'll get a notice and everything. So it's a really great service. But you can do all kinds of really cool stuff from inside of a Travis build. You can say, okay, run this PHP unit stuff and then send the code coverage details to Coveralls. And so then Coveralls will say, okay, what's your coverage like? So you get these sweet badges for your repository to say, like, you know, you got 80% code coverage and your Travis build is passing. And so there's like this emergence of all these tools and all these badges. Do you guys care at all about those badges?
I don't.
A little bit. I wouldn't say I care much about them. There's this new tool called Scrutinizer that came out.
Oh, I was just about to bring that up.
Yeah, it came out, I don't know, a few days ago, I guess, or at least that's when I first saw it. And I ran Laravel through it, and like we got a good rating and stuff, and a decent high number. But I looked at some of the bugs and stuff, and I wouldn't necessarily consider them bugs. Yeah, like a few of them were like dot block problems, you know, just because PHP is so dynamic and stuff. And a few of them were like, I could kind of go either way. But, yeah, I mean, it was okay. You know, I checked to make sure we weren't like a horrible rating. And once I saw that we had a decent good rating, I think it was like high sevens, almost eight. And then I was like, okay, good enough.
It's pretty impressive, though, some of the stuff. Like, some of the messages it will give you are so readable. It's almost like somebody actually looked over the code. I was testing this out yesterday, and it was like, oh, my God, it looks like a human being actually wrote this. It doesn't feel like some kind of automated, you know, error message that you're getting. It's very readable. And yeah, a lot of them, when I did it the other day too, a lot of it's like, oh, this only accepts an array, but it looks like you could pass it a string. And it's like, no, it's just I accidentally set the doc block wrong. But what's cool about that is it will, if you want it to, it will automatically submit a pull request to fix any of those little issues that it can do. Wow. So you can automate those fixes completely.
That is
the whole product is super impressive. Like whoever built it, yeah, definitely kudos to them.
Yeah, I'm makes me even that more curious to see what CodeClimate's going to do. They've been advertising PHP support for a while now, and I don't know if it's in beta yet. I signed up like months ago, but I'm very excited to see what happens from that.
Yeah, on this database package we talked about on the last podcast, I just slapped a whole bunch of badges in there. Like I looked at somebody's repo and said, oh, those badges look kind of nice, so I just slapped them all in there. And then the Sensio Labs Insight badge, like Mitchell committed in the PHP artisan command that he wrote for the package, and we went from like 4 stars platinum to 1 star, and so we're going looking through. It's like what is it complaining about? And it's really hard to really kind of care. Suddenly it feels like, are we spending more effort just trying to support this badge? I mean, it doesn't seem to offer any real value in this specific context. So
it reminds me of like 7 years ago when like valid CSS and valid back then XHTML was a thing, you'd get these badges, and I did it too. Everyone would paste those little badges into the footer to let, for some reason, their viewers who know nothing about these technologies know that it's valid CSS and valid XHTML.
It works in the browser.
Yeah. Yeah. Netscape Navigator.
Like some random viewer of a blog's like, oh, that's very nice. Valid CSS.
I only browse sites. Yeah, I only browse sites with valid CSS.
What is this? Not valid CSS?
For the discriminating surfer.
But yeah, back to the testing thing. Like, I don't blame anyone for being cautious about it because it's overwhelming. I wrote about this a lot in my book. It's overwhelming. You have PHP Unit, PHP Spec, Mockery, Prophecy, Behat, Mink, CodeSet. I mean, you can just keep going on and on. And people don't have the time for this, you know. It's a very small subset of people who are interested enough to research these things. So I don't blame anyone for just not knowing where to start. And then even beyond these frameworks, you have all the different kinds of testing. Like you have acceptance and functional and integration and unit and end-to-end. And then every single community has their own words to identify the exact same kind of testing. Like what the Rails community might call unit testing, our community would call more of an integration test. So it's like, how could you possibly know if you're just reading some random blog how to go about doing this stuff when nobody agrees? Even now, I get frustrated thinking about it. It's very rough. It's taken me many years to get to the point where I feel comfortable writing tests and doing TDD, if that's what I want to do. But yeah, I don't blame people for having trouble with it.
I feel like it's like a long-term pursuit. It's something that you can't just decide to do. And so I'm gonna test now, and then the next day you're like pulling your hair out because you don't know what you're doing. And I'm sorry, it's just gonna take a while. We're talking about like a year to get your feet. You know, really, it'll pay off sooner than that, far sooner. But and it will make you probably a better object-oriented designer. I just think it will.
Oh my gosh, immensely better.
Remember the CodeIgniter unit test class? That was kind of ahead of its time, though. Am I right? Like,
I don't remember that.
Has anyone ever tested a CodeIgniter application? I'm not sure that ever actually got used.
Dude, I used that for sure. Like when I first came to CodeIgniter from my previous job and stuff, like I was like, sweet, unit testing. Of course, I had like no mocking or anything, which is like totally necessary for unit testing. But now that I think about it, like it's kind of crazy because unit testing was not like a hot topic in those circles, but they had a unit testing class. Is kind of interesting.
I think we're sometimes unfair to CodeIgniter. Like, I think we're all doing it in good fun, but we forget, like, back then, CodeIgniter was awesome. You know, it's sort of like how we look back on Internet Explorer 5. It's like complete garbage by today's standards, but people forget, like, when IE5 came out, that was a significantly better browser than anything else on the market at the time. But it's like we look back at it now, and it's complete garbage, but you have to think about the time. CodeIgniter was good for the time. We just make fun of it now whenever we can.
I don't really try to make fun of it as much as, like, I look back at old pictures of myself as a kid, and it's like, I can't believe I wore that. And it's like, I didn't, I'm not trying to make fun of myself, but it was just a different time, you know?
Man, that is so true. Like, I look at some of these photos of myself as a kid, and it's like, who allowed you to wear this, you know? And we thought we looked good back then.
I didn't think any such thing, for the record. I was decked out in Kmart plastic print shirts and who knows what. So nobody thought that I looked good at the time.
You mean those t-shirts with like the really thick plastic front?
That yeah, like a picture of an electric guitar and lightning bolts.
Some LA gear, light up shoes.
That sounds about right.
Anyhow, if anyone's listening to this and you're not doing testing, what I would recommend is try to write some kind of acceptance test. That's an easy way to do this. You can use Codeception for it, which is probably your easiest choice, or if you want to dig into the hat. But that gives you a much easier way where you're not having to worry about, like, oh, is this class testable? You're just saying, here's what I want to do. And you could call that a feature. So you could say, like, I don't know. Maybe it's just something as simple as, like, you want to sign in to your application. Well, you could write a little feature that where you just write it exactly the way anyone would say it, and then you can handle a couple of tests to make that work. That's a really good entry point to this stuff. And then you can start digging in a little bit further, doing more integration style testing, more unit testing, but start on the outside in, just like a human would.
And if you want to leverage like your own psychology, when you screw something really big up and you feel awful and everybody hates you, you might consider writing a test to make sure that doesn't get screwed up again. So I think that always like kind of worked for me, because if I'm working on something that's just too complicated for me to really wrap my head around it entirely, then I have no choice but to either resign to it failing and then fixing it as it fails, or write a bunch of tests to kind of force it to fail and then figure it out.
Definitely. Are any of you guys using PHP spec at all?
I'm not, but I'm very seriously like kind of looking at it. Since you brought it up, can you kind of tell the visitors kind of how PHP spec differs from something like PHP unit?
Yeah. It's just, I'm probably not the best person to say this, but it's just a different approach to writing your tests. So with PHP unit, obviously you use more of like the X unit style where you say, assert equals 4, 2 plus 2. You know, just your traditional unit style testing. With PHP spec, it's more about design than testing. So it's more of like, if you wanted to do test-driven design, PHP spec is really good for that. So you describe what your object should do. So many times I'll look at people's tests with PHP unit, and it'll just say, like for the test method name, it'll say test and then the name of the method. And that's it. So you don't exactly know, all right, what does this do? Well, you're just making sure that the method does what it says. And this is a dead ringer that people are writing the tests after the production code, which is fine if you want to do that, but you're not helping your future self, or you're not helping anyone who comes to this project that knows nothing about your code base. They just know that you have some test that verifies that whatever it does well. But with PHP spec, you can focus a little bit more on the behavior. What does it do? So when you write these names, you know, you're actually writing it like a sentence. What should this object do? And then you write it down. And then you can create any mocks you want to automatically, which is pretty cool. Like, for example, with Mockery, if you want to mock something, you use the Mockery API, and then you insert that into your class, like dependency injection, but you insert a mock. With PHP spec, it's sort of like how you know, with Laravel, with controllers, it will use automatic resolution to inject your dependencies into your controller. PHP spec is very similar to that. So you just type in the name of the object that you want to mock as an argument of the method, and PHP spec will just automatically give you that. So it just makes for much cleaner code, in my opinion.
Yeah, the spec tools, the various unit testing tools that follow that kind of approach seem to be really in style with a lot of I don't know, the people that the kind of, I guess you'd call them thought leaders if you want to sound all TEDx about it.
I would, like, honestly, See, what's hard though is PHP spec isn't for everything. So people get really like there are so many support threads everywhere from Laracast, who I've seen some on Laravel.io, to the PHP spec GitHub page, where people are trying to figure out how can I use PHP spec with Laravel. And what this amounts to is they're trying to test facades, and PHP spec isn't making that easy. And that's what's really cool about the framework is it kind of nudges you. I don't want to say the right direction, because in the last podcast I said there was no right. Okay, let's just say it tries to help you write better code. So anything that you are having trouble doing with PHP spec might signal a code smell. So in this case, if you're trying to test a class that references a class in your domain that references a facade, it's going to make that a little difficult. So instead, you can change your production code to maybe inject the underlying class. And you can do that in Laravel now. So there's just lots of little things that PHP spec will nudge you in the right direction. So it's like primarily a design tool. It helps you design better code.
Whew.
I feel like I'm a Laracast.
This one's for free.
No, if you're on Laracast, like, you guys should see when I record a video at Laracast, there's like 500 edit points. Because nobody can talk about this stuff well. You know, it takes me sometimes like 10 tries to get a sentence right, but then I'll just edit out all the mistakes. One of these days, I will just do a video but not edit anything out, and you can see how bad they turn out when it's just me.
A video on how to edit videos? That would be really helpful for me. So I wouldn't have to do any of these screencasts in one take anymore and have to do it like 20 times.
It is fun. Like, I do love watching screencasts because everyone has their own like style of doing things. For example, Taylor, when I watch your videos, I think every single video you do says, "Hi, I'm Taylor Otwell, back with another Laravel screencast."
Yeah, my wife says that sometimes around the house.
Yeah. Or what is the other one? There's one you do... Oh, yeah, whenever you hit a route, you're like, all right, I'll hit that guy. Everything is a guy. And I have a bunch of my own that I do. It's fun. Like,
he also talks about spinning through iterators.
Yeah, spinning.
So when is Laracast open for everybody to submit a video?
I don't know if that'll happen. I don't know. I would love to have, if I ever did anything like that. Yeah, like what I would prefer to do... what is the site? I'm already drawing a blank because I'm on a podcast. He did Ruby stuff and then he got bought out by Pluralsight. It's the great Ruby. Mm.
What is Railscast? The name of that?
No, the other one. Why am I drawing a blank? Jeffrey, of course I'm drawing a blank. Peepcode. Peepcode.
Okay.
Well, now I have no idea what I was saying. What was I talking about?
Peepcode and curating other people's content or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He does this play-by-play thing where he'll meet somebody probably at a conference, and they will just get a hotel room, and they will sit down and work on a project. And
fire it up Ember.
Yeah, firing up Ember, just like that. And I learned so much from those because they're way less about actually finishing the task that is assigned, and it's more just watching your workflow. And I don't know about you guys, but like that's where I learned so much. Is just how do they go about their editor? If they want to run some command, how do they do it? Do they pop open, for example, in like PHP Storm the little command prompt, or do they switch to the terminal? Do they have some kind of shortcut? That's where I really learned the most. So I might think about doing something like that for Laracast, where I give people it would be perfect for conferences. Like if I could pay Taylor some nice amount of money just to hang out with me for an hour and code.
It would take that much for Taylor to hang out with somebody.
Yeah.
For sure.
But you get the basic idea. That would be the only thing I would do. Otherwise, I really like the idea of kind of owning Laracasts. Mm-hmm. I had that big problem where I used to work at Tuts Plus, where we had so much content, but it was coming from so many different people and so many different backgrounds. So you would have one course that might suggest one technique, and the other one would say, oh, that's a bad way to go about it. And that's just because naturally developers disagree on this stuff. But as somebody trying to learn, that's very difficult.
Yeah, you don't
when
have
you can say, well,
voice.
He just told me not to do that, and you are. Yeah, so with Laracast, I like, even if I'm not right all the time, I like that you have a very specific viewpoint that you're learning from.
Consistency.
Yeah.
When I started making screencasts, basically when I started doing any community contribution at all, I was making CodeIgniter screencasts, and I didn't think that anybody had ever, like, watched them, so I just belted them out, like, one take. Mm-hmm. And then I started getting a lot of people talking to me about them, and eventually those were the way I was able to start my business, because people would come to me and say, hey, I like the way you do things. Will you build this for me? I'm like, okay, cool. And so now even I mostly just do the recordings in one take. Last time I was at Laracon, somebody came up to me and said, you know, I you know, like that you're talking about, like, Laravel and these screencasts and everything, but I much more appreciate the things that you're not directly talking about, you know, the things where you're just rambling off the top of your head about something or another, or, you know, to see, like you said, what you're doing with your editor. And that really kind of stuck with me. So I try to make sure that the videos I record are as real as possible, because if I design a script, then that's me making something. And I think I probably have a little bit more to offer than just what I would design myself. So I'm not going to handicap myself in that way and just draw a line about, you know, what my videos are going to be about, and just try to keep it as natural as possible.
Oh yeah. I would never do a script. I wasn't suggesting that. When I talk about editing my own videos, it's more like you want to say something, but you don't know the perfect way to say it. So I'm not reading off of a script. It just means it might take me 3 or 4 times to get out what I'm trying to say. But yeah, the problem with scripts are you already know what you're going to say before you start. So there's no room for quick asides. Those little, like, oh, by the way, this is kind of cool. Did you know about this? That's where you can really learn some stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a lot about testing and stuff, huh?
For sure.
So do you guys want to talk about suffixing your classes and different types of types, I guess? Like, for example, PSR2 from the FIG, they say to suffix every single interface with the word interface and suffix every single trait with the word trait. I know, Taylor, that you had some strong opinions on this. Did you want to go first, or maybe hear from Max?
Sure. Max can go ahead. Go for it.
I'm not doing this yet.
Though? I mean, is it something that...
Yeah, that's something that I'll use, yeah. Just to make it standard, clear, you know.
I believe Taylor's viewpoint is he just doesn't want to get yelled at by the PSR police.
Yeah.
Every time it comes up, Taylor's like, oh, I just don't want to get yelled at.
I don't like it in the code. I don't like how it reads. Like, I would rather say, for example, with cashier, user, class user, and then use billable. Like, that, to me, that just is more, it just sounds better. But I do kind of like how I can type interface into, like, Sublime or trait into Sublime, and I get all of the traits and stuff, which I wouldn't necessarily get if the name wasn't in the class or in the interface or trait. So I don't know. I don't like it in the code at all. Like, I think that sounds stupid, really stupid, to say, like, implements whatever foo interface, when I would just say, like, for example, with PHP itself, they just do implements countable or implements array. It really should be array accessible, not array access, which also sounds stupid. But, yeah, I don't like it in the code, but I do like it in terms of Sublime Text, which I shouldn't be using anyway.
I was gonna say, Sublime is great.
Maybe if you had different tools that would give you those things back.
That's okay, Taylor. I'm on Sublime Text right now as well. I tried PHP Storm also, you know, just switching between the two. So I'm on the same boat.
Sublime is great. A year and a half ago, I was saying it was the best editor ever. So it's incredibly good. Either one works. It just kind of comes down to, I think, not to get into this again, but it just comes down to, I think, your sensibilities, what you feel comfortable
using. What you want
using.
In the moment.
It's not like people have been separated between, like, an IDE and something minimal like Sublime and Vim forever. I mean, this debate just never stops.
Yep.
And both sides are right. Yeah, it's religious debates.
But you are correct, Jeffrey, in that I do it just so that, what's their name? PHP Fig won't get mad. Not that I care, but just so they won't get mad. Because, yeah, we do follow PSR1 and we do follow PSR0. We don't actually follow all of PSR2, so I guess I'm kind of inconsistent in that way, but, you know, yeah, I do try to stick to it as much as I can, I guess, just to kind of play nice.
Jeffrey, do you have an opinion on it?
You know who writes a lot of great stuff on this is Matthias.
Yeah,
Braze. Bring him up a lot. What is his name?
I'm sorry. I know it as Matthias Ferris, but I am probably wrong.
No, I'm probably wrong. I have We're all probably wrong. This is the problem when I work at home, is I don't actually speak to these actual people, so I just guess how their names are pronounced. Anyways, I've learned so much from him. He has a lot of good ideas on this, and he has an article called Sensible Interfaces. Just give it a Google, and it'll make you, like, if you are a hardcore always suffix interface, just give it a read, and maybe just take a step back and think for a minute. Honestly, from my point of view, I haven't made up my mind yet. I've done both. Yeah.
Uncle Bob's been talking about this in .NET for like 10 years or whatever, where in .NET everyone prefixes everything with like I, so like ifoo class user implements I billable or whatever, and he was talking about you should drop the I, you know, with any new suffixes or whatever, and for the same reason, like, because he was always coding to interfaces or whatever, like the interface was almost the most important part of it all, so he was like, you might as well not suffix it at all and make that kind of like the main focus, as he said, of interfaces or contracts or whatever. It's kind of an old discussion, really.
Yeah.
That's really kind of where I stand on it. If you're going to suffix something, then suffix your concretions. To me, let's say I have an interface. So give me a good example real quick. Like, because I all I can think of is command bus off the top of my head.
Well, okay. Like there's traversable.
Okay, so I'm going to go with the command bus thing. So let's say I want to inject a command bus into one of my controllers. And so you can see this on the next version branch on the Laravel IO code base. I inject command bus, and then I just do $bus. Command bus is actually an interface, and I have multiple command buses in the code base. So the important thing is I want a command bus. And I don't care what I'm getting. It just really doesn't matter at that point. The code, in my opinion, doesn't care. What I don't want is a command bus interface. So a command bus interface isn't even instantiable. Either way, it doesn't make sense to say that $bus is going to be an interface. It's almost like semantically wrong in my head to say mm-hmm. that this is what you're expecting. But you're expecting a abstract concept. You're expecting a command bus, and so when I inject it, yes, I'm injecting, and there's also another part of this where you have the default implementation problem, which is if your interface is command bus, then what's your command bus called? Well, the reality is, yeah, naming things is hard, and you have to actually kind of think about it. So, I used to have just a normal command bus class, and what it would do is it accepts a command, and it pairs it with a handler. So the command comes in, it gets paired with the handler, and then the command bus is out of the picture. So I decided to call it the execution command bus because its job is to execute the command, essentially. And then I have another command bus called the validation command bus, and it just decorates the execution command bus. And then I slap it into that same, I just bind it to the IOC container so that when it injects, I get the full stack. And in some of my controllers, I might want that, or I might want to change the implementation at runtime. I just want a command bus. I don't want a command bus interface. I just think it gets in the way. It almost, like, to me, relegates the concept of interface to like a second class citizen, where, like, I guess Uncle Bob, who's been influential to me. I guess my thought is interfaces are kind of super effing important in object-oriented design. So I think of interfaces as a little bit more front and center, I guess.
It's true. You do see a lot of people try to use class names like default and then whatever the interface is called. And that's always a little weird. Like, I guess an easy way to... Yeah, well, I definitely don't either. I guess an easy way to think is what makes this implementation different from that implementation, and then whatever you come up with, that should probably be the class name.
Naming is hard.
That's a hard thing to grasp. Like, naming is hard. I think when you're younger, you're like, wait, what do you mean naming is hard? But it's like you don't even know enough to realize how hard it is just yet. You have to get to the point where you like. I think if I can give Taylor a compliment, you do this better than just about everybody. That's why Laravel's so nice. It's just like exactly what you would expect is how the API looks. And what I think people don't realize is that's weirdly very, very difficult to do. Or it's just a gift you have. But I think for most people, it's incredibly difficult.
You know, that's the whole story behind Facades, or the name Facades. You know, for those who don't know, a few weeks ago there was this huge controversy that we should rename Facades to Static Surrogates or something like that, because they're not really implementing the facade pattern. But that's exactly why they're called Facades, is because I try to name things, or when I was writing Laravel, I try to think of very plain English names to describe what something is doing, and I'm not always necessarily I don't always have my, quote, programmer hat on, so, like, sometimes I will come up with very kind of prosy-sounding names that might not always mesh well with computer science names, and so that's where the facades came from, is because they kind of are a facade in the English, in the sense of the word, like the English dictionary sense of the word, but they're not a facade in the kind of Gang of Four design pattern sense of the word.
So they steal the word, so if you now try to use it any other way, suddenly you're stealing from them. That's how that turns
right.
out.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do try to name things with a very prosy kind of expressive syntax.
I think the naming problem actually is a little bit deeper than that. To me, it's like you're making a nice API to work with, and I think, you know, you have a passion for that. It's like every time you talk about these things, you're like, oh, you know, I start with the API, or I just want the API to be really nice. And I think that makes, you know, a lot of sense, and it kind of makes Laravel what it is. But I think the issue with naming kind of comes back to the complexity of exactly what we're doing. So if you're thinking about code in a very procedural way, then, you know, from top to bottom, you're trying to just get these bits arranged into these bits, and that's basically it. But when you're doing something a little bit more, I don't know, philosophical, something like, you know, object-oriented design, all of a sudden you have all these little units that have these specific jobs, and what you originally may have thought was a good name maybe doesn't fit it at all anymore. You know what I'm saying about this? Am I just kind of rambling in nowhere?
No, I get what you mean. Naming stuff is really hard, and especially naming stuff that's going to be used for a long time, like things, hopefully, in Laravel. You know, you have to stick with those names for a long time, so it is kind of daunting.
Yeah, it's not like
you
can do a switcheroo 6 months later. You have to stick with it. I think it's tough because for whatever reason, maybe our instinct is not to make things more simple. And that's why, like, when you see method names, they're very short. We try to shorten or abbreviate even words. And it's like, well, why are you doing that? And it's because, oh, it's obvious, but it may not be obvious a year from now. So I've started to get to a point where, like, even if my method name is too long, that is preferable to some method name where I don't exactly know what it does. Mm-hmm. So even if that means, like, one thing I do a lot is, let's say you have some kind of conditional, and it's like, if, and then you have some kind of conditional. I don't know, maybe you're, like, reading some properties array to see if a field exists. It doesn't matter. But, like, rather than putting that all inside the conditional, I would extract that to a method and then just name it exactly what that does. And that way, a year from now when you come back, you're not having to take, even if it only takes 5 seconds to figure it out, you're not having to think, all right, what exactly is that doing again? No, you just know exactly what it does because the method name says that.
Extract till you drop, baby.
Extract till you drop.
The funny thing is, if you think that the names of your functions are or classes are long, I suggest you just look at Objective-C documentation, where
Objective-C
they have, like,
scares me to death. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's like 200 character names, you know, for things, but they explain exactly what they're doing.
So have you done much work in that area?
quite a while ago, probably a couple years ago. Yeah, I made
a few
games. No, it was not as easy as web development, because it has a lot of all kinds of, you know, memory management and all that kind of stuff. At that time, probably, like right now, it's probably a lot better to get into. But
I should probably learn it. It scares me. Like when I was working at Tuts, I hired this guy to do a course on Objective-C. Actually, the Brian, the guy who creates CodeKit. Mm-hmm. I was working with him, and he did, like, a killer job. But I was going through the videos, and the code was just so, like, foreign to me. I couldn't get my brain around it, which probably means that's exactly why I should learn it. But still, like, it's very intimidating to me.
Same here.
Uncle Bob, DHH. I'd like to see those two in a ring match.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
Cage match. Uncle Bob versus DHH.
That'd be super interesting. I would definitely pay to see that.
Uncle Bob comes in dressed up with, like, a cape and stuff.
Uncle Bob's kind of like Ric Flair, you know?
Have you seen like his video series, his cleancoders.com video series, Taylor?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's There's like good. 25 episodes now.
My and wife makes fun of them so much.
I don't know how you couldn't. They like get progressively crazy. Like at about episode 12 or 13, it just starts going like out the window. Like he's smoking his pipe and there's explosions coming out of it. And like he rides a bomb popsicle through space. And I just don't even know what I'm watching anymore. And, you know, I really think that he breaks things down in a really good way. Like for he spends a full hour talking about single responsibility principle, for example, and he talks about it. He gives a lot of code examples and he gives you enough information to be able to gather the concept together. But it's also sometimes a little bit awkward and weird. Like when he has like his, you know, the his kids in his family and they're all like swinging around lightsabers. I'm like, I am so not able to pay attention while people are swinging lightsabers and hitting each other and stuff. It's just, some of it's a little weird, but thankfully he mostly keeps it kind of low.
It's pretty good stuff. It's an acquired taste. That's what I would say about it. Like a lot of people, if you want to learn about the single responsibility principle, that's a great place to go. But also expect the first 45 minutes to be some story that you have no idea how that relates to code or how it ties into this. And he usually does in the end, but you'll spend a half an hour listening to some story related to NASA or something where you're like, wait a minute, what does this have to do with anything?
I love
this. But it's all good in the end, you know?
I love the science lessons.
Yeah, I do too, but it's acquired.
I had a professor like that in college that was like always talking about when he used to train on T-38 fighter aircraft. And he was like this awesome, smart professor, but like there was always like a T-38 lesson in there somewhere.
Hey, man, go with what you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see here. Yeah, so I have a question for you. I have this like personal idea about this, but I want to give you guys all a chance to talk before I kind of rant on it for a second. But I was wondering what you think about developers using their mental focus at work, like, for example, over like a 9-to-5 job or, you know, like an 8-hour day, and then the ramifications that that has on their life. Do you guys have any strong opinions on this?
I do. Do you guys ever notice, like, I don't know, I think it depends on how you work, but sometimes when I have a long day, I am so mentally drained. I think this job is more mentally draining than most jobs, to the point where when I do get done and I'm with my family, it's like I have trouble getting out of that coding zone where I'm exhausted, but if I'm still working on something, I can't get that out of my head. I guess it's kind of like this weird addictive quality. I don't know how to describe it. Do you guys know what I'm talking about at all?
One thing for me, let me see if this is the same thing you're talking about, where like it used to be I'd get off work and like if I go to Subway or something, like I'm still like in this hyper OCD attention to detail mode. And so like they'll ask me a question, like a normal human question, and in my head I'm thinking, wow, that made no sense. Like like they'll say something like, do you want chips with that? And I'll be like, with what? You know what I mean? Like in my head, I'm like, you're not being specific. And it's just like this over attention to detail that takes me like 30 minutes to kind of wind down and kind of get back to normal, like vague human conversation, you know, because you're dealing with like very precise code all day.
It does kind of warp your mind over the long term, right?
Like, yeah, like it never stops. I guess that's what I was trying to say. It never stops. Even when you go to bed, you're probably on some level still thinking about it, or things just kind of making their way through your head. That's hard. I sometimes envy the people who have those jobs where once they're done at 5 o'clock, that's it. They will not think about it. Yeah, exactly. Office space. They won't think about it again until the next morning. And I think there is value in that.
So I think
it would drive me nuts at the same time, but there's value in that.
I think we can also kind of argue causation versus correlation, right? So it's more, you can argue, and I think that you could probably find information studies that suggest this as well, that people of a certain mental temperament are more likely to have a job where engineering is involved, right? So actually, I actually have heard of a stat, and you can go and look this up because I feel really confident because my old lady told it to me, and she wouldn't tell me something that wasn't backed up by science, being a researcher herself. But she said that there is a very specific probability that the child of a researcher will be somewhere like autism spectrum, or not a researcher, engineer. the child of an engineer will be somewhere autism spectrum. So, like, you know, not like unable to handle, not like, you know, necessarily awkward in social situations or anything like that necessarily. Just the way that the mind, their mind works is, you know, of a specific flavor. So I think that, people who end up to be engineers end up having, of course, there's all types of people, and some people get into programming. A lot of people get into programming who actually don't even care, and life just blew them that way. But I don't know. I can imagine that people of a certain mental temperament kind of flock, I guess, to this sort of thing.
That's interesting. You mentioned imposter syndrome in the last podcast. Do you guys feel like you have that?
Every day of my life.
Taylor, what about you?
Yeah, I'm not a legitimate programmer for sure. Like I truly believe like I'm not a real programmer. And let me explain that. I mean, like the people who build, the people who make PHP Storm, or the people who like make Nginx or PHP itself, like those are real programmers. You know what I mean? Like I'm kind of just like piggybacking on their real work and building like these kind of cute little tools to help us do stuff. But yeah, yes. I don't feel like a real programmer in that tools. Way.
That should be the name of this podcast. Cute little tools. So I know exactly quaint. What you mean. Like I know this isn't totally related, but I'll go watch a new Pixar movie or something. And it's so incredible that they made that happen. And then yeah. On our end, like I'm excited when Rounded Corners came to CSS, you know, that's, it's like this massive gap between capabilities. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? There's different types of programming. You know, there's that kind of systems programming, and but there's also, you know, business applications programming, which I don't think it's it's just kind of can be a different skill set sometimes too. You know, like figuring out and having insight into finding viable business ideas or how to structure something like that is a different skill set entirely, and not necessarily like a lesser skill set. I would say it's just different.
I do game programming on the side, and that to me feels more like real programming because I write something, I just make a small tweak, and then I go and interact with it, and suddenly I feel like I have something moving and alive in my hands. Whereas, when I'm doing, I'm basically in my regular job just encoding business logic, if that makes sense. And I think it's really great, and I think it's fun, and I enjoy researching and learning about how to do it, how to organize my app and all those things, but I don't know. There's something about being able to directly interact with my game projects that makes me feel very differently about programming.
I think in my head, I tend to view any programmer that like heavily uses math as our quote real programmer, and the rest of us are as like kind of fake programmers.
Which is funny because I happen to know a lot of people who use math heavily who are awful programmers, but it's just part of their job. Like statisticians and whatnot, they get the math. They only have to make this simulation run once, so they don't know anything about code and managing it and the life of a software engineer.
Mm. I'm always curious if, like, basically everyone I talk to says they do have imposter syndrome, but I wonder if that's true. I wonder if, like, it's more connected to your personality type, and is it just maybe that the type of person who would flock to this part of the industry is more inclined to have that, or is it because this stuff is so hard? I don't know.
We're also on a podcast that's going to be listened to like 5,000 people. So if you're the kind of person who's sticking their neck out, how does that affect that?
Yeah. Exactly. But there are people who would say I don't have it at all.
I don't feel like I have imposter syndrome within PHP. Like I feel comfortable with my PHP skills, but I do feel like in the wider programming world, I would be average at best. You know what I mean? Like in terms of real programming, average to below average, probably. I think I'm good at PHP. I don't know that I would be necessarily special outside of that.
It's hard that that counts because that's kind of your domain, right? So like it makes sense that in your domain you feel comfortable because this is where you put a lot of effort and time, and it's a complicated domain. So that, you know, thinking about something that you don't have much experience with, it makes sense that you wouldn't be as skilled or as comfortable. So I think that really definitely counts. You know, it's probably a factor in imposter syndrome in general, just having the awareness of all the things you don't know and then you kind of just like you do your own little thing and you're doing all right and you're doing a pretty good job, but there's still just so much you can't know.
Right.
I have a little bit of input on that too. I guess I see it as, you know, just using the tools that are existing out there, you know, to get where you want to be. So the main thing for me is just to use this programming or, you know, it doesn't have to be just this language. It can be any other programming language just to make what I want to make. So, but that's probably a little bit different for me than for other people because I'm mainly working for myself at this point.
You can still classify it, though. Like, do you feel like other people are passing you by? Do you feel like you can't keep up with everyone else? And my instinct is, okay, well, then you don't have it because I very much do have that. And I think plenty of people do, this feeling like everyone else is ahead of you. They know something that you don't know. And I think you either have that feeling or you don't. Yeah. And it doesn't make you right or wrong. It's just whether that's your inclination.
Where I did have that was on front end. Until very recently, like, I felt very insecure about my front-end capabilities and felt, like, very one-sided as a developer in the sense that I could only do back-end .NET or PHP, and I couldn't do anything else. And I felt like, I don't know, I didn't feel good about that just from, I didn't want to get left behind too far for too many years. And so, like, I have this project at work and on the side, which I'll talk about at Laracon, where I had to use a lot of front-end stuff like Angular, and I actually had to learn how to do Bootstrap and Less and all that. And that was really good for me to not or to get into those areas where I haven't been. And it really kind of boosted my confidence, I guess, as kind of a more complete developer. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend, you know, if you feel that way, just kind of tinkering around with some idea and not giving up, because it's really nice to kind of have that feeling of kind of catching up, so to speak, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Good advice.
If it's okay with you guys, can I kind of go back to kind of the 8-hour workday thing real quick?
Yep, yeah. Let's do it.
So I've been in whatever this career path for like 16 years or something. And I worked, you know, for startups where I was working 12, 14-hour days where I actually lived in the guy's house who was running the startup. So I just moved from another town into his house and just lived there and worked there. And his mom would bring us food. and we would just be working all the time. And so that was cool and that was fine for the time for me. But so I'm 32. I have two kids. My wife is, you know, at the university and – basically, I can't really even anymore get more than like 5 hours of good client billable time in a day, because when I do, I feel like the rest of my world kind of falls apart. And so kind of in observing this in myself, I started really thinking about what it takes out of us to do what we do. And it's a lot of on time. It's a lot of focus time. I really believe there's like a limited amount of chemicals, like certain chemicals in your brain, or vice versa. The more you work, the more your brain's flooded with these chemicals that just like drag you down and keep you from being able to think clearly. And I think a lot of developers who work full time end up solving that problem on their own through, you know, Reddit, Imgur, you know, these distractions. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, maybe if you work an 8-hour day or like work 9 to 5 and you come home, like what's your home life like? At work all the time, you're coming up with new ideas. You're solving problems. Is your home life also coming up with new ideas and solving problems? Are you maybe not considering, making an improvement to your home or tweaking something out, or even just doing the kind of housework that would make your home a better place to live for you, to increase your quality of life? Is there a possibility that those things are seriously negatively affected by working so long and just basically trading your energy on a day-to-day basis for money? So I wonder if we spend so much of our time trading that ability of ourselves for cash that we ended up even just, even on our day off, just recharging. We end up at like a lower potential. And then maybe we're at their highest potential at the end of the weekend so that we're back and we go back into the grind again. And this is definitely like one of those first world problems where if you're suffering, you're not having enough food or something, that, well, these are exactly the kind of problems you'd love to have. But I'm just thinking that if you have kids, for example, and you go home, is it hard for you to interact with your kids? Do you find that like on a Sunday you have really great interactions and you're just so thankful for your family, but then maybe on other days, you know, you're maybe more frustrated or have more difficulties? Does anybody here have experience with that kind of like negative impact on their personal lives?
Yeah, I can kind of relate to that where when I get off work, usually like I have to go like lay down for about 15 minutes and just kind of chill for a second and decompress. And then it's easier for me, I think, to kind of come out and have normal human interactions, so to speak. But yeah, sometimes I do find myself like even on downtime contemplating different programming things or thinking about stuff. So it is kind of hard. I can relate to that.
Yeah, you can't turn it off. That's the hardest thing. It's very difficult to turn it off, even if you want to. Sometimes I'll finish up. Maybe even I decide I'm going to finish up early. I'll be done for the day. And before I know it, 2 hours later, I'm back on it doing something. It's, for me, it's this weird addiction where I can't turn it off. And like, I don't know about you guys, but sometimes if I'm working on some project and I finish for the day and, for example, the tests still haven't turned green, I can't relax knowing that. So I will go back, and it's worth it to me to spend an extra 2 hours if, when that 2 hours is done, I can actually relax and not think about it. But until then, it will just stay, especially if I'm going out to dinner with my wife or something. Of course, like she has very specific rules that I have to follow. So I can't just make her wait, and I'd be a terrible person to do that. But it doesn't change the fact that I'm still thinking about it when I should be watching a movie at a movie theater or something.
Yeah, I'll be sitting on my couch, like, watching a movie, and I keep popping my laptop open thinking, oh, I want to refactor this thing in my package, and I close it again, because I am not mentally capable of doing a good job, because I just spent myself on, you know, this thing all day, and then into part of the evening, so I just keep opening my laptop like a compulsion, like, oh, what's over here?
Yeah, it's an addiction. Have you guys ever found yourself at 2 a.m. in bed on your laptop working? And the answer should be no, but I'm...
We literally do not take our laptops to bed. It's kind of like a thing we just don't allow.
Well, that's good. Taylor?
One thing, no, I've never actually...
What, am I like the only loser who works in bed?
No. I was going to
edit all of this out.
I've done that before.
One thing people don't know about me, though, is before I started Laravel, shortly before I started Laravel, I was like a total Luddite. I did not have home internet. I did not have a cell phone. Not a smartphone, not a regular phone, no cell phone at all. And I had no computer at home. I had nothing. And I was like this kind of, I was like really into like minimalism and stuff, like overly obsessed with it and like having nothing. Like I wanted to get rid of our furniture. Like it was weird. And then when I started Laravel and I got into programming, I kind of like, I don't know, just something shifted in my brain, I guess, where I didn't care about that stuff as much anymore. And so obviously I had to buy a laptop, and I got like the cheapest laptop ever at Best Buy, and it sucked so bad. And I used like Notepad++ or whatever, because I didn't know about Sublime Text. And, yeah, but I mean, it was like, I had so much free time and my mind was like so chill. I don't know. It was just like a different thing. And yeah. I wish I could kind of go back to that a little bit, to where I'm trying to get back into it now, where like if I'm on the couch, I put my phone like somewhere else and I do not check it. And like the temptation is so strong to check Twitter. It's so strong. It's so weird.
It's weird because like I can tweet basically any of you at any time of the day and I'm probably going to get a response in a few minutes.
Yeah.
And it's true for me as well. And it's like, even if you put the phone across the room, it will somehow end up back on the couch.
I know. I'm like justifying it in my own mind. Well, like I really do need to check on this thing. And while I'm here, maybe I'll check Twitter, you know, it's like justifying my phone usage in my own mind when I should just be like relaxing.
It's like Sean just pinged me to make a joke. Like I've already gotten that. I hate that, you know, we shouldn't be that available, but somehow There's a lot of articles on this stuff if you read about it, like our need for constant, I can't think of the word, reaffirmation, constant stimulation, constant people letting you know that what you're doing is okay. You know, there's a lot of levels to this stuff, more than just, oh, I'm addicted to Twitter. Because it's not really that, it's something else.
I still think phones in general are so weird. Like, people call me, and they expect me to answer and listen to them at any time of day. And I'm talking about just anyone, you know, not just programming. But it's like, I don't leave my front door just open all the time. You know what I mean?
You're like, such a hermit.
There's kind of this double standard with technology, to where, like, you expect people to be available now.
Really? I don't have that. I think that the... That is like a manifestation of the fact that you're free to launch yourself at somebody and they're free to ignore you.
Yeah. Well, it's like my dad. I hope he doesn't listen to this podcast, but my dad, he says, I love text messages because I can send a text message and you don't have to respond right away. Like, I could, for instance, I could send you a text message, you, Taylor, and if you're busy, no big deal. Like, you can just respond when you have time. But invariably, when he sends me a text, like 5 minutes later, it's like, hey, did you get my text?
That happens on Twitter too. They email you and then you get the tweet letting you know you were just emailed. Like, oh, thanks. Because I get email updates too.
Wow.
I didn't think we'd talk about this, but important.
Just wanted to make sure my email went through, because they're known to just disappear all the time.
I know, it's like, email is pretty reliable, you know. You don't need to verify whether I got it. Pretty reliable.
Yeah, I feel bad because I'm probably a little bit too good at letting some of that stuff go.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that it's probably a good time to wrap up, huh?
Probably so. We're pretty far in.
Does anybody have anything they want to bring up while we're here?
Yeah, I had a little announcement. I've sent an email and a tweet to Taylor saying about it.
Did he get back to you?
He tried.
The technique with Taylor is if he doesn't respond, he's probably... All right, never mind. Keep going.
Yeah. So it's basically like an Easter present for the Laravel community, and I've decided to make it out and to make it public. So basically, probably thousands of hours of work that went into the book, the Laravel in Action book. All the diagrams and the manuscript, I want to donate it to Laravel in general to improve the docs and to make it really nice. Yeah, there's about
diagrams.
as much of it as needs to be. So the diagrams, the manuscripts, there's about 10 chapters that are ready, and quite a lot of them are very helpful for the beginners, especially, and for those who are just trying to learn Laravel. I think those diagrams can really improve a lot of the documentation for anybody who wants to learn. And so that's one of the things that I've heard a lot of times on Twitter and on the forums, that the docs, they need some improvement. And I think that would be a great thing to do, that to implement some diagrams and some more explanations that are much more in detail.
So Max, right now, if somebody wanted to go and find this content, how could they find it?
I'm going to post it up on the blog, but I also sent it as an email to Taylor for him to go through it and to decide if he wants to do this or not.
Documentation is a very tough thing. Like, maybe the Laravel doc should have a section for additional learning or something, because you want to be very careful. Like, the documentation, a lot of people criticize it. I actually think it's quite good. But, like, you want it to be succinct enough that somebody, if they want to learn about sessions or queues, you can click on that page and basically have a good idea of what it can do within a few minutes. So it's not like always adding more and more and more to it is better, but you still want to make that information available if people want to dig in more. So how that can be implemented into the docs, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's one area we haven't really touched on, is visual things like Max has created. That's kind of one area we haven't even explored, is any kind of picture or anything like that. So that'll be interesting. I'll have to look through them.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I reference the Laravel docs all the time. So like Albert Einstein said, like, never memorize something that you can look up. I'm always looking at what classes are under the facades, or, you know, any number of things. So I think the Laravel docs are good. I think that there are omissions, but at the same time, it's really hard to I don't know, really be super complete. It's just really difficult. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge. It's something that could probably be improved on, like anything ever. It's just going to be something that is always going to be difficult.
I think it was something that Taylor mentioned on the last podcast about a section on the docs or something for like the beginners to learn MVC, to learn, you know, all those small little things. Maybe that could be a good place to do it there.
Yeah, we do kind of make some assumptions on the docs, and I think part of that is because maybe like at the time we were assuming a little too much because people were kind of migrating from other frameworks. But now that Laravel has gotten more popular and more mainstream, it's becoming people's first framework, which wasn't really the case a couple of years ago. So, yeah, we are kind of having to recheck some assumptions we make on the docs, I think, in general.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap it up. Thank you guys so much for coming on, Jeffrey, Taylor, and Max. This podcast literally couldn't exist without, you know, you guys coming on and chatting about stuff.
I love it. I love the podcast.
It's awesome.
Me too.
Hopefully other people like it.
Well, we...
Yeah, do we know if anyone's actually listening to this?
We're just talking out into space.
I put the podcast 12 up yesterday, and after 20 minutes, I went to, I wonder if anybody like, you know, has listened to it. I hit reload, and it was like 250 listens have been started, and I was wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, because you don't want to find out that we've been doing this and like 8 people listen to it.
No, we have about, on average, like 5,000 listens per episode.
Wow.
Sweet.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, it's really cool. So, if anybody's listening, if there are certain things you like or don't like about the podcast, definitely just tweet it at Laravel.io or, you know, one of us. That's great. Always good to learn more about it. Cause I think we're starting to sort of figure out our voice a little bit. It's kind of like experimenty, trying things here and there. But yeah, I think that we're kind of figuring out a little bit about what we have to offer, I guess.
Yeah, I like the style of podcast where everyone's just completely honest. So if you're having a lot of trouble, like there's no facade, to use a good word. There's no no facade of how you should be. It's just be honest of what you're having trouble with or what you don't get.
All right. Well, thanks again, everybody. Stay tuned for the next exciting episode of the Laravel IO podcast.